I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. This month marks 100 years since Albert Einstein published his revolutionary theory of general relativity, building on his earlier ideas about matter, energy, and light being linked, but going further to understand that really massive objects like galaxies can actually bend light. Astrophysicist Mario Livio joins Midday as we delve into the mind of one of science's giants to get a glimpse of how Einstein reached his conclusions and how they affect our lives every day. Plus, every year, thousands of patients whose lives depend on a bone marrow transplant can't find a match. We'll learn why it's so hard and hear from a donor in Maryland whose donation saved the life of a boy in California. It's Midday at noon after the news. Welcome to Midday, everybody. Sheila Cast here for 88.1 WYPR. I'm very glad you tuned in. It was 100 years ago this month that Albert Einstein put forth his theory of general relativity. Later this hour, we'll mark that centennial when we speak with astrophysicist Mario Livio. We'll talk about how Einstein reached his revolutionary conclusions and how they still underpin scientific concepts we see in action every day. But up first, on this Veterans Day, we're going to talk about the life-saving move of donating bone marrow, which too often doesn't happen when a bone marrow match can't be found. Our first guest is Navy Lieutenant Kavika Segundo, a recipient of a Purple Heart and the Administration Department Head for the Naval Health Clinic in Annapolis. Welcome to the show, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Also joining us by phone is Amy Haskew, a representative from the nonprofit Be the Match. Be the Match is operated by the National Marrow Donor Program. It works to facilitate bone marrow transplants, along with providing patient support and education. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
Lieutenant Segundo, last year you found out that you were a bone marrow match for a patient in California. Tell us about that moment when you found out.
I can remember it like it was yesterday, because I remember walking home and just about ready to get in the house when I received a phone call, and I didn't know who it was. And first thought I was thinking, oh boy, this is another telemarketer. And picked up the phone, and you know, they introduced themselves as, you know, the bone marrow, and wanted to confirm who I was. And they briefly described to me. They said, hey, we think we have a person that's in need. Are you willing to donate? And, you know, it was an absolute yes. It was no hesitation.
You had volunteered at some point earlier to have your name on a list of potential donors?
Yes, ma'am. So, being in the military, being in the Navy and in Navy medicine, I was put in the position, opportunity, that we do a lot of bone marrow drives in the military. And at that particular time when I was stationed in Norfolk, Virginia, they did a drive down there, and it was a simple process. They do a swab, and then you're just good to go, and you're in the registry.
The recipient was a young boy, age 7, named Kyle Crawford, who had been diagnosed with aplastic anemia, and the only way to cure his illness was for Kyle to receive a transplant of healthy bone marrow cells from a donor. Kyle could not find a match in his family. Finding an unknown donor proved very difficult because Kyle is mixed race, half white, half Chinese. Amy Haskew, talk about the relationship between race and bone marrow.
So there is a misconception out there that matches are made based on blood type, and in fact, blood type is not that important. It's not a major marker. We match patients and donors based on something called your tissue type. That is genetically inherited from your mom and your dad, and because it's genetically inherited, you will most likely find your matching donor with someone that shares your own racial and ethnic background.
And what are bone marrow transplants used to treat?
So marrow transplants are currently a cure for over 70 different diseases. That includes the blood cancers, like the leukemias and the lymphomas. However, we also do treat for diseases like sickle cell, some autoimmune disorders, and some genetic disorders as well.
And how many bone marrow transplants are done in the U.S.?
Right now, we are facilitating over 6,000 a year, but those are only the transplants that we facilitate, which are using an unrelated donor from the Be the Match registry. So that is not including the transplants that have a matched or familial donor.
And tell me more about this process of finding a donor for a mixed race recipient like Kyle. How hard is that?
Well, it can be very difficult. So going back to how matches are made based on your tissue type, which is genetically inherited. So specifically, if your ancestry or racial background is something fairly unusual or fairly rare, you might have a much more difficult time finding a matching donor. So like in particular, Kyle is Chinese and Caucasian. So that's a little bit different as opposed to finding a matching donor for a patient who is 100% Chinese ancestry or 100% Caucasian ancestry. So we're mixing the two together, and that makes it more difficult. So some tissue types are very common. Some are a little more uncommon, and some are just incredibly rare. So if you are multi-race, more than likely you do have a very rare tissue type, which means it's going to be harder to find you a matching donor.
Lieutenant Segundo, did you have in mind, since you do have a background in health, when you volunteered to be a donor, did you think that your heritage was going to make you an especially valuable donor?
No, not at all. You know, I didn't realize, you know, at the time as far as the, you know, as far as being mixed race and, you know, having that mixed race as a recipient was, it would be rare to find a match. You know, I didn't realize it at all. You know, I know it now. You know, and so now, you know, I knew there was a need back then, but now I can see the greater need now, and you know, it's critical to try to you know, have people come in and donate, and especially mixed ethnic races. I mean, it's so important to get them in there to donate.
That's Lieutenant Kavika Segundo of the U.S. Navy. He heads the administration department for the Naval Health Clinic in Annapolis. And here on Midday WYPR, we are talking about his decision to donate bone marrow. We're also talking with Amy Haskew, who represents the nonprofit Be the Match. Lieutenant Segundo, this is kind of a challenging concept because we tend to our whole push for diversity in the United States, we tend to think of people as not being very different under the color of their skin. We tend to think that people are all the same. And so now we're told, no, actually, when it comes to something like donating bone marrow, your racial heritage is tremendously important.
Yes, yeah, and I agree. You know, your racial heritage is tremendously important, you know, when it comes to, you know, the biology of it and what people need. And that's why I think, you know, maybe there's a little bit of complacency out there as far as, you know, being on the registry, because maybe a lot of people think, oh, no, you know what, it may be just a blood type, and somebody else will help that individual. But, you know, I beg to differ that I think that's far from the truth, because, you know, there's statistics out there where, you know, especially with minorities and ethnic races, you know, only about 30%, you know, of those in need will find a match. You know, that leaves the 70%. I mean, 70% that's not going to find a match at all. And that's just heart-wrenching. And, you know, I just cannot imagine being in that person's shoes or that family member's shoes and just hoping and waiting and praying for that somebody to be a match. I just can't imagine that.
Amy Haskew, tell us about the process. How does the registry work to get more people and more people of mixed race to sign up?
So we do a lot of work with education and outreach. Like Lieutenant Segundo mentioned, there are a lot of myths and misconceptions out there regarding marrow donation. A lot of people don't realize that it is very hard to find a match. It's not as easy as a blood type. So it doesn't matter if you're AB negative or O positive. We're actually looking at your genetics, and they are varied. We have millions of different tissue types, so every tissue type out there is important, especially if you are of diverse racial background. Another problem is there's a lot of fear surrounding marrow donation. medication. A lot of people think it's incredibly painful and it takes a long recovery time, when in fact there are actually two different ways you can donate. And the most common way of donating, about 80% of donors will donate in a procedure very similar to a platelet or a plasma donation. Only 20% of donations these days are actually marrow and are surgical, which if you do marrow donation, it is under general anesthesia, which means you're asleep for the entire procedure and you don't feel a thing during it.
Lieutenant Segundo, tell us about your operation. This was last September, right?
It was, yes, ma'am. It was last September, and, you know, I underwent the surgery. But, you know, it really wasn't that bad at all. I think the fear out there is far worse than what you experience because, you know, number one, they set you up. I mean, they have somebody that walks you through it before, during, and after. You know, and then, you know, they're so professional. You know, there's so many different sites where you can get this done, but my particular one was at Georgetown University in D.C., and, you know, the process was smooth. The nurses and doctors were great. You know, they prepped me, and then I went through the surgery, got out of surgery, and I can just equate it. You know, a lot of people are afraid, oh, wow, it's painful. I can equate it. If you haven't been to the gym in a while and you go ahead and work out and then your muscles are sore, I can equate it to that.
I'm sorry, Lieutenant Segundo. When I hear a Purple Heart recipient say, oh, it's not that painful, I'm not sure that that applies to me.
Well, I mean, so being a Purple Heart, I don't think it equates the two because, you know, I think I can determine pain level. I mean, it's the pain really, it really wasn't that bad. I mean, I can honestly say it was kind of like having a sore muscle in your back. And the real, not even challenge, but it was the fatigue after, because your body's replacing the bone marrow. And, you know, a lot of people think, oh, wow, you know, I'm losing my bone marrow and that's it. No, you're replacing it. But for a couple weeks, 2-3 weeks, you just feel a little fatigued. But, you know, you take more iron pills and it replenishes it. And then after that, you're good to go. So I would encourage people to do this. I would do this over and over and over again, because when I got out of the surgery, when all was said and done, I was like, wow, it really wasn't that bad.
Amy, ask you, if somebody does want to sign up for the registry, what should they do?
They can do two different things. So they can actually attend a local donor registration drive, or they can actually join online. And I did set up a promo code in your guys' name. So they can actually go to join.bethematch.org/WYPR and register, and we will mail them a swab kit.
Can you give us that again?
Mm-hmm. It is join.bethematch.org/WYPR.
We will link to that from our website. We've been talking about how this is not like, it's not governed by blood type, but are there, mm-hmm. is the same kind of classification system for types of, I mean, are there like 4 or 5 categories that by which you classify marrow donors?
Right. We can certainly tell them their tissue type. However, it's probably going to be completely meaningless. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as A positive, A negative, O positive. Your tissue type could be 1X:2X:A.
And we've been talking about mixed race, but also are there people who we might not think of as mixed race who, from the perspective of bone marrow, really are? I mean, I'm thinking of African Americans who may have ancestors from different parts of Africa.
Correct. And actually, African American is one of the hardest groups to find a match for. So if you're a Caucasian and you're searching for a matching donor, your odds of finding a matching donor in the registry are over 97%. If you identify as African American, your odds are going to be a little bit lower, and they're going to range between 40 and 75%, depending on how close that match needs to be. There is one follow-up comment for one of Lieutenant Segundo's comments. He talks about the patients they're searching. On average, our registry is searched over 3,000 times a day by doctors looking for a matching donor for a patient in need.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Lieutenant Segundo, you consider this pretty urgent.
Oh, extremely. Yes, ma'am. I consider it extremely urgent. because of the percentage. You know, when they said, the statistic was saying that for Kyle, you know, it was about a 4% chance. And, you know, I could just imagine there's probably hundreds and thousands of, if not thousands of recipients in need of bone marrow that fall in that category. So I definitely think it's urgent. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
U.S. Navy Lieutenant Kavika Segundo, a Purple Heart Administrative Department head for the Naval Health Clinic in Annapolis. He is a bone marrow donor. And Amy Heskew, who represents Be the Match, the nonprofit that helps find donors for sick people who need them. Amy, give us one more time the link we can go to.
To order your own swab kit, you can go to join.bethematch.org/WYPR.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've taken a short break here, and when we come back, we'll focus on another kind of science, Albert Einstein, and the 100th anniversary of general relativity. Stay tuned for that. Welcome back to Midday on 88.1. Sheila Cast here. This month marks the 100th anniversary of a theory that completely changed our understanding of the world we live in. In November 1915, a 36-year-old university professor in Berlin published equations showing that massive objects like galaxies can bend light. The professor's name was Albert Einstein, and his equations became known as his theory of general relativity. It was a big deal, although non-scientists like me are hard-pressed to explain why it's a big deal. Einstein wasn't dealing in a scope we experience in daily life. We're not traveling vast distances in space at the speed of light. But a few weeks ago, when the renowned astrophysicist Mario Livio suggested we should talk about general relativity as it marks its centennial, I thought, this would be an interesting conversation. While he was senior astrophysicist at the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute, Mario Livio wrote several best-selling books of popular science, including Is God a Mathematician? And most recently, Brilliant Blunders from Darwin to Einstein. Welcome to Midday.
Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. You know, most of us hear Einstein and relativity, and we think, aha, E equals mc squared, and we know E is energy, and m is mass, and c is the speed of light, and that's all we know. That's what we know. That equation really wasn't the news in 1915, was it?
No.
That's not what we're talking about here.
No, that was the news in 1905. That was Einstein's theory of special relativity. And that in itself was already a fairly dramatic revolution. Because Einstein introduced for the first time the concept that space and time are somehow related and we should not speak about them separately, that there is this entity which we now call space-time.
That was already in 1905.
Yes. And that was his theory of special relativity. And that introduced that famous equation that you mentioned, where mass and energy are equivalent. You can turn mass into energy, energy into mass. And that was already pretty amazing. It also introduced all kinds of strange concepts like that when things move near the speed of light, length changes, events that are, you know, happen simultaneously in one frame do not happen simultaneously in another frame, and a whole bunch of, you know, very perplexing things.
So what was he still then after that, all of that in 1905, what was he still turning over in his mind? What problem was Einstein trying to solve?
So there were two things in particular that his theory of special relativity did not address. One was gravity, the force of gravity, and what does that do and how does it do anything? And the second thing, even at some level more importantly, is that all of special relativity dealt with observers that move at a constant speed. They don't accelerate or decelerate. They just move at a constant speed. But you see, in everyday life, actually, most of the time we see accelerations.
Really?
Yes. You start your car, the car accelerates, right? The Earth is rotating. You know, if you are sitting on that Earth or on any carousel, there is actually a centrifugal acceleration to that. You take any turn
because it's a rotation; it's not
right,
a direct line.
Right. Oh. There. You know, you take any turn with your car and so on. It's an acceleration. Every time you stop, you start walking again and so on. There is an acceleration. Everything that falls to the ground is accelerating, and so on. So. Acceleration is a very, very important part of physics, and special relativity just did not address that.
So I still am trying to picture how a scientific mind like that carves out the issue that it's addressing. I mean, I still am trying to understand whether Einstein said to himself, I'm going to come up with a theory that explains everything, or did he have a more limited, definable goal, and did he reach it?
It was not limited in any sense, because his ultimate goal was to formulate physics in such a way that the laws of nature, these things that we think govern all phenomena, would look the same to any observer. Whether the observer is sitting on a chair, whether the observer is moving at a constant speed, whether the observer is accelerating in a rocket or sitting on a carousel, and so on. So he wanted a theory that would somehow look into all of that. And at the same time, he wanted to take on Newton's gravity and put that also in the same framework to explain what gravity is all about. You see, in Newton's gravity, there were some strange things. Newton thought that gravity happens instantaneously. For example, let's suppose, the Earth moves around the sun, right? Mm-hmm. And it's held by gravity. The idea was that gravity acts instantaneously, yet light moves at the speed of light. So imagine that somebody, for example, suddenly made the sun disappear. If somebody made the sun disappear, according to Newtonian theory, immediately the Earth would not feel the gravity and it would just start moving on a straight line into space because there would be nothing holding it in orbit, right? At the same time, it takes light about 8 minutes to get from the sun to us. So we would actually not see the sun disappearing for another 8 minutes. So what's going to happen is suddenly the Earth would not feel the gravity, but it would only see the sun disappearing 8 minutes later. This is bizarre, right?
So, well, I would point out that the whole premise that the sun's going to suddenly disappear is a bit bizarre, too.
Well, but as a thought experiment, okay. You can think about that. That's Einstein loved thought experiments, we call them Gedankenexperiment, where he thinks, what would happen if. And so the whole concept of gravity propagating instantaneously was a problem. So that was one of the things that Einstein was trying to solve. And you asked, had he succeeded? Eventually he did with his theory of general relativity.
Well, eventually. I'm struck that you pulled this idea of thought experiment in. Einstein was not doing physics experiments the way I did physics experiments in high school, was he? I mean, he was doing most of this in his head.
Yes.
Or against what was he testing it?
He was testing it against his head. And he was really phenomenal in his ability to think about these thought experiments. For example, one of the things that led him eventually to the theory of general relativity, which is the thing we're now celebrating the centennial of, is that he suddenly thought about what happens to a person that free falls. A person jumps out of the window and falls freely. And he suddenly realized that a person like this does not feel his weight at all. When you fall, free falling, you don't feel your weight. If I put a bathroom scale underneath you, you and the bathroom scale would fall together, and you know,
and you're exerting
it would
no
not
pressure
register, yeah, any weight.
And that's a concept we've gotten somewhat used to because of space travel and
right,
learning
that's
about
right.
astronauts in space, but that was
right.
a new idea.
But when he thought about that, he said that was one of the happiest thoughts he's ever had, because he suddenly realized this thing, that a person that free falls does not feel his weight. So this person could not know whether or not he's actually falling in a gravitational field or is just in a place where there is no gravity at all. So that led him to this incredible realization that acceleration acts like a force of gravity, if you like. And, you know, I can just go on with this example. You see, if you stand on your bathroom scale and you're inside an elevator, and if the elevator is accelerating upwards, then
you
would
more.
Press more and it would show more. Now, if you were inside this closed elevator and didn't know anything that's happening outside, you would not know whether or not you are in an accelerating elevator or whether somehow you're in a place where gravity is a stronger force. Similarly, if the elevator is accelerating downwards, then the bathroom scale will show less because you will press less on the bathroom scale. And again, you would not know whether you're in something that's accelerating downwards in a gravitational field or you're in a place where the gravitational field is just weaker. So he realized this thing, which he later called the equivalence principle, that acceleration and gravity are the same thing, essentially.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with astrophysicist Mario Livio, author of several popular books of science, most recently Brilliant Blunders from Darwin to Einstein. I confess on Wikipedia, that when the Times of London covered the news of Einstein's general theory of relativity, the headline they put on, banner headline, was Revolution in Science, New Theory of the Universe, Newtonian Ideas Overthrown. Did they get it right?
Yes, at some level. But, you know, overthrown is a bit of a strong word.
It is?
Yes. Newtonian gravity still holds for most of the things that, you know, we do in our everyday life.
Yeah.
We even calculate the trajectories sometimes of rockets, you know, and so on, using Newtonian gravity and so on. Newtonian gravity was excellent. But like all excellent theories, at some point, if they are really good, they get embedded in a larger theory. And that's what happened. Newtonian theory is a limiting case of Einstein's general relativity. So in that sense, it was not overthrown. It was superseded, if you like.
It was sort of put in a box.
It's a subchapter.
Right.
Yes. But in terms of a concept, this was truly a revolution. Because as a concept, you see, Newton talked about the force of gravity, that any two masses attract each other and so on. But the force itself was mysterious. I mean, how do they attract each other? You know, these two masses that are just in empty space, how do they attract each other? Einstein completely changed that. And he said, all that the force of gravity is, it's the curvature of space-time. Let me explain that a little bit.
Yeah, that
because
I'm
it
lost.
Sounds, yeah, the curvature of space-time. Suppose I stand on a trampoline. If I stand on a trampoline, I cause the trampoline to sag, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I put a very heavy object on a trampoline, I'll cause the trampoline to sag. Now, imagine that you will throw small balls onto that trampoline. The small balls will find the path that is actually the shortest path in that curved space. What Einstein told us, that's what gravity is all about. Masses, like the sun, curve space-time in their vicinity, And the planets, in the case of the Sun, find simply the shortest path in that curved space-time. So it's not some mysterious force. It's just a manifestation of this warping of space-time. That's what gravity is all about.
You keep using the phrase, and I know you told us a few minutes ago, it came from 1905. It's older than the centennial we're celebrating of general relativity. But space-time is not something I have any intuitive understanding of, and it sounds to me like what the example you just told us could have been, you could have dropped the time and just talked about space.
Well,
is it important to get this concept? And if so, make another pass at trying to explain it to me.
Absolutely important, and I'll tell you why. Because of the fact that I'm talking about space-time, actually these masses, they don't just warp space, they warp time as well. So, for example, where there is a very strong gravitational field, time actually ticks slower. And by that I mean everything that you associate with time. Your clock will tick slower. Your heartbeats will tick slower. Every process in your body, your thoughts will be slower. Everything, when gravity is stronger. So let me give you an everyday example where this is being used. An everyday example is, you know, we now have in our smartphones, we have a GPS system.
Mm-hmm.
The GPS system uses a system of satellites, 3 to 4 satellites that emit a signal to our phone, and they triangulate on our position, they find where we are, and that's how, you know, we manage to drive or walk or whatever to get to where we want to go. Now, these satellites, they have two things with respect to the ground. One is the satellites are very far, they are tens of thousands of miles away, and as a result of that, they feel a weaker gravity than we feel here on Earth, because they are farther away from the center of gravity, in this case, the Earth. A second thing is that because they are in orbit, they move very, very fast. These two effects affect time. The fact that they move fast makes time tick slower for them than for us on Earth. That's from Einstein's special relativity.
Uh-huh.
Okay? The fact that they are in a weaker gravity than for us on Earth makes the clocks there tick faster than on Earth. That's from Einstein's general relativity. We are in a stronger field.
Do they compensate?
Not exactly, no. These are two separate effects. The clocks in the satellite do the corrections for both of these effects, believe it or not. And if they hadn't done these corrections, we would actually be off by a few miles, perhaps every day, from the accumulation of errors in our position. So, believe it or not, our GPS system in our phone system uses special relativity and general relativity. You know, you started by saying that we don't encounter general relativity in our everyday life, where we actually do.
I stand corrected. We are going to take a quick break here. Renowned astrophysicist Mario Livio is staying here with us. We'll talk more about 100 years of general relativity, and I hope hear some more examples of how this force is actually a force in our lives. Albert Einstein published it 100 years ago this month. We're going to take a break. Stay with us. I'm Sheila Kass. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday on 88.1. Sheila Kast here. It has been exactly a century since Albert Einstein published what's now called his theory of general relativity, a centennial that scientists are so excited about. The United Nations declared 2015 the International Year of Light. I'm here with astrophysicist Mario Livio, author of many scientific papers as well as several popular books, the most recent of which is Brilliant Blunders, From Darwin to Einstein. One of the things that confused me as I was trying to get spruced up a bit for this interview, part of what the theory of general relativity led to was the understanding that most of the universe we can't see, we can't experience. It's dark matter or dark energy. How did Einstein get to that?
So Einstein didn't get to dark matter, not at that time. At some level, he got to dark energy in a way that I will explain in a second. So general relativity is very special in that it is a theory that applies to the universe as a whole, because it applies to space-time as a whole, which is, you know, the whole fabric, if you like, of our universe. It actually turned space-time from some sort of a background, which it was in Newton's theory. In Newton's theory, space and time were absolute and were just a background. In Einstein's theory, space-time became a major player in what happens to the universe. So our universe, for example, we say our universe is expanding. What is really expanding is space-time is expanding. A bit like, you know, think of a surface of a balloon. If you have, you know, if the galaxies are points, painted points on the surface of this balloon, and imagine that the whole universe is this surface, then as this balloon is expanding, then what happens is that the fabric is expanding, the points get farther away from each other, even though the points themselves don't actually move on the surface of a balloon. So that's the situation. Now, dark matter is matter that does not shine any light, doesn't absorb any light. How do we know it's there? We know it's there because of its gravitational effect. It holds galaxies together, clusters of galaxies together, because there is much more of it than matter that does emit light. The matter that
this seems like a huge act of faith to me. It's apparently not an act of faith to astrophysicists, but to posit that the vast majority, like 90-95% of the universe, we can't see, and we only know because of some clues it drops. That just mystifies me.
Well, it actually mystifies us as well, I must say. It's not as if, you know, we've gotten a little bit used to it, but it does mystify us because, you know, as it turns out, I mean, all the matter we know and love, I mean, the stuff that you and I are made of, stars are made of, you know, the luminous galaxies are made of, that's less than 5% of the energy budget of the universe. This thing we call dark matter, which really acts like matter, it has gravity and acts like matter, that is about 25% of the universe's energy. And about 70% is in this form, which we call dark energy. But let me first say about the dark matter. So dark matter is, we think these are some particles that we have not yet discovered, but where we see their gravitational effects. We see how they bend light, like Einstein's general relativity tells us to do. We can, in a way, weigh the galaxy. You know, find its weight from the way it bends light for more and more distant galaxies behind it, and so on. And that's how we find that there is a lot of mass there that we don't see. Hopefully, one day we will actually discover these particles that constitute. There are many experiments right now that are looking for those. Now, dark energy is a different business. Only in 1998, we discovered that the expansion of our universe is accelerating. It's speeding up. Not only is our universe expanding, the expansion is speeding up. How come? I mean, you know, if everything attracts everything else, I mean, the expansion should be slowing down because, you know, everything is attracted to everything else. Instead, we discovered it's speeding up. And the thing that is speeding it up that exerts some sort of a repulsive gravity, if you like, that's the thing we call dark energy. And that's about 70% of the energy of the universe. So that's the thing that is perhaps the most puzzling at the moment, because we really don't have a very good clue as to the nature of this dark energy. We just see its accelerating effect, basically. But it's related to Einstein, believe it or not, because in 1917...
This theory was out.
Right.
Was it being called already then general relativity?
Yes, it was called very early on general relativity. In 1917, 2 years after he published his theory of general relativity, Einstein tried to apply it to the universe as a whole. And he realized that, you know, these things, he thought that the universe was static, that nothing was moving, because he thought that was more elegant, that the stars don't move and are fixed in their places in equilibrium. So he realized, yeah, but if everything attracts everything else, it won't stay in equilibrium. So he added a term to his equations, a fudge factor, if you like, which we now call the cosmological constant, which exerted this repulsive force. So at every point in space, it exactly balanced the attractive force of gravity at that point. And he thought that he would make his universe static, in equilibrium this way.
But wouldn't that have meant that Newton's apple would not have fallen because there would have been some force pushing Newton's apple up again?
No. That force actually is such that it increases with distance. So on distances like
short,
the...
On a short fall, on gravity.
Even on the solar system and so on, you don't feel that at all.
Okay.
So only on the vast, you know, expanses of the cosmos you can actually see that. So he added that. It was not a great idea to add it there because while it produced an equilibrium, it was not a stable equilibrium. I mean, you know, the slightest perturbation, things would have collapsed or you know, accelerated. But anyhow, he added that in. Then in the late 1920s, astronomers such as Edwin Hubble discovered that our universe is not static. It's expanding. When Einstein heard it's expanding, he said, oh, wait a second. If the universe is actually expanding, I don't need to add this term that will put everything in equilibrium, because then all that gravity will do, it will slow down the expansion, which is fine with me. And he took that term out from his equations. And that's what people like to say, that he said that this was his biggest blunder. Yes or not, you know, I investigated that at some level. But in any case, he did regret it.
He regretted having put the...
That extra term in. Yes, and he took it out.
And then you say in the 90s, learned
right.
Adam Riess from Johns Hopkins
That's
was
right.
one of the scientists who won a Nobel Prize for this discovery that the universe is accelerating in its expansion.
That's right. Exactly.
So is it good that Einstein took out...
No, it's actually very bad, because as far as we can tell, what is causing this acceleration that Adam Riess and his colleagues discovered is actually exactly that term that Einstein took out. So if Einstein made a blunder at all, it was taking it out rather than putting it in. And had he actually left it in, he might have been able to predict that the expansion of the universe should be accelerating.
That's astrophysicist Mario Livio here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about how the theory of general relativity that Albert Einstein put out 100 years ago this month is still having an impact on science today. If Einstein had not discovered this, was it in the cards that somebody else would have come up with it?
Not really, no. This is what makes it so great, that general relativity was not in the air at all. Once Einstein presented his main ideas to his colleagues, then this famous mathematician Hilbert actually was able to formulate equations that came very close to formulating general relativity. But that was only after he heard Einstein describe, you know, everything and so on. Other than that, I would say that idea was not in the air at all. And I'll be honest with you, to this very day, I just cannot for the life of me understand how he thought of it.
I read a quote from Roger Blanford, a scientist at the Kavli Institute for Particle Astrophysics and Cosmology at Stanford, that struck with me. He said, meaning Einstein, he was guided not by mathematical ideas or mathematical techniques. He was guided first and foremost by physics intuition. That extraordinary, powerful physics intuition, which had served him so well in the past, did not let him down here. Close quote. I'm not sure I know what physics intuition is, but it sounds like art, not science.
It is really something amazing that very few of us really have. You see, Einstein, he saw so clearly his ideas and where he wanted to go that, you know, if you look at his papers today, about 20% of them contain mistakes of some form or another. But in a number of cases, he makes mistakes along the way, and at the end, he gets the right result. His mistakes somehow correct themselves along the way, and he gets the right result. That is the sign of real insight or real intuition. He knew exactly, you know, what he thought the picture should be. In the case of general relativity, by the way, he struggled with that for years because his mathematics, you know, we like to think of him as this great mathematician, but he really wasn't. I mean, he was a very good mathematician, but he was not one of the greatest mathematicians. And in his mathematics, he often needed actually help from friends like Marcel Grossman, his very close friend who helped him with the mathematics of these things. But his physical intuition was just, you know, incomparable.
After he published General Relativity in 1915, was he left with still more nagging questions that he would try to address as he had moved from special to general relativity?
So one was that business of trying to solve for the entire universe, and that resulted in that paper in 1917 in which he introduced the cosmological constant, then took him out and so on. Later in life, he was obsessed with combining, unifying all the forces of nature. Now, in his case, you see, the nuclear forces were not even discovered when he was a student. So to him, the basic forces of nature were electromagnetism and gravity. And he tried to unify those into a single theory. As it turns out, unifying gravity with everything else is the hardest part. And so to this very day, we're still struggling with unifying gravity with the rest of it. The nuclear forces and electromagnetism, we have fairly successful theories that actually achieve that. But Einstein, of course, didn't know that at the time. So he was actually continued for the rest of his life to struggle with the hardest part, which we have still not solved to this very day.
But that's why you say it was a revolution.
General relativity?
Yeah.
Well, the reason I say it was a revolution is because, especially because it changed completely the role of space-time. And also because it wasn't in the air at all. I mean, everything that, you know, special relativity, just to make the distinction, special relativity was definitely in the air. The famous mathematician and physicist Henri Poincaré came extremely close to formulating special relativity on his own. And had Einstein not done it, it would have been done within, you know, a very short time. General relativity, absolutely not.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Mario Livio is an internationally renowned astrophysicist and best-selling author of popular science books, the most recent, Brilliant Blunders, From Darwin to Einstein. Thank you for listening to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be back tomorrow.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.